gender may be a social construct, and sex may be less binary than we once understood. In order to make a baby, though, you need an egg cell made by a female body and a sperm cell produced by a male body. That is, unless you could make those sexual reproduction cells in a lab out of stem cells, in which case you could conceive an embryo with any two parents you want, regardless of their biological sex. You could even conceive a child from reproductive cells derived from just a single person. Welcome to the future of fertility. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The technology known as IVG for short, in vitro gametogenesis, makes old school in vitro fertilization seem downright primitive. We're a long way from doing this with actual humans. Right now, scientists are working mostly with mice. But if and when they find a way to make this work for people, it could radically change the way we conceive children and define parenthood in the future. Emily Witt is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where you can read her article, Fertile Ground. Emily, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Until a few years ago, nobody was entirely sure it would even be possible, right, to make a gamete or a sexual reproduction cell out of some other kind of cell. Tell us about these two scientists in Japan who managed to demonstrate this was possible, at least for mammals.
Yeah, they still haven't proven the technology for humans, but for mammals, they've managed to take some skin cells from the tip of a mouse's tail, reprogram themselves back into stem cells, which have the capability of becoming any kind of cell in the body, and then turn those cells into egg cells, fertilize them as you would with IVF, and they've made mice pups from them.
And those mice pups turned out to be normal, healthy little mice, right?
Yeah, they appear to be normal. There was a pretty high failure rate for the embryos, but they still, you know, they managed to birth a litter of pups.
Is it a process, is it a similar process to get sperm from stem cells as it would be to get eggs from stem cells?
You know, they haven't, you know, I actually don't know because I wrote mostly about egg cells. Sorry about that.
That's fine. But down the road in the future, scientists do think this would also be possible. Is that right?
They also think it would be possible. That's correct.
Assuming the day comes when we can do this reliably, the societal implications, Emily, might even be more interesting to think through than the science. First of all, it might be possible to turn a cell from a biologically female body into a sperm cell, or a cell from a biologically male body into an egg cell.
That's correct. And the process to make a male to female cell is a little bit less complicated. So they've actually managed to do that in mice as well already, create a mouse with effectively two dads.
Wow. And this obviously could pave the way for same-sex couples who want children to both be biologically related to those children.
That's correct. That is the promise of the technology.
How could this technology create the possibility of a child with DNA of more than two parents?
By, you know, I don't know the science that well, but because it's possible to... you know, to do it with one, you can also theoretically at least do it with what would be four parents.
Wow. It would also, this is the one that blows my mind, be theoretically possible for a single person to provide both gametes to conceive an embryo. But this is not the same thing as cloning that person, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it would be different from cloning. And it is conceivable, although probably ill-advised because of recessive genes that might cause, you know, a genetic illness.
Aside from this more maybe radical stuff, this could also be a game changer for people with infertility issues. Why might many patients prefer an alternative to the current method of egg harvesting for in vitro fertilization?
Yeah, those kind of out there science fictional scenarios are almost like less compelling than the possibility this holds for people experiencing infertility or even people that aren't. So as many people who've maybe gone through IVF know, one of the biggest obstacles is getting enough egg cells, especially from women. And it's a very invasive process. Typically, you stimulate your body with hormones to produce more egg cells than it normally would. And then you have a surgery where they're extracted from the body. And in the end, you might only have, 5 or 10 eggs to work with. And the failure rate for IVF is pretty high. So this holds promise, A, for people who might not have a supply of egg cells, so older women, women with premature menopause, women who have gone through cancer treatment, all kinds of things like that. And then it also holds promise in the sense that in being able to create more egg cells than usual, you could also make many more embryos than usual, which gives rise to the possibility of kind of greater genetic selection for, to optimize her health and to eliminate the possibility of genetic diseases.
So, given that this technology, if I understand it correctly, would theoretically create like a fresh egg, right, for a prospective parent, that's why it could extend the window in which women can get pregnant. I mean, women close to menopause may still have eggs, but those eggs are pretty old by then and more likely to be damaged, right?
Yeah, so egg cells are formed in utero. So, for example, the egg cell that made me was actually made in my grandmother's body in 1947 when she was pregnant with my mother. So, it's kind of amazing to think about that. So, we're born with all the egg cells that we'll ever have. And as we age, that number and quality decline. And so, IVF, if you're reaching the end of your 30s, typically is not as successful, not only because you have fewer egg cells, but they tend to be not quite as robust as they would be when you're younger.
And people going through IVF and the egg harvesting process, we should say they just don't feel good while this is happening for the most part, right? Those hormones really do a number on how you feel physically.
Yeah, I can speak to this personally because I froze my eggs when I was 39. And you have to give yourself shots every day. You have to go in for constant monitoring to have blood work. By the end of the time, your body's really bruised. You feel bloated. You feel swollen. You're exhausted. It's very expensive and kind of an unpleasant experience to have to go through.
And of course, you have to plan ahead in order to freeze those eggs before it's too late. And, it's not always an emotionally easy decision to come to.
No, I mean there's a lot of pressure on, I think, women especially who have a very fixed timeline in which they're able to get pregnant. But often you're in a relationship sometimes with another kind of person who's on a totally different timeline, and it puts a lot of pressure on women to get everything done by a certain age at a time when we're living longer and we're doing things later in life, and adult life doesn't progress with the same speed as it used to. So I think there's a real desire to find a way to prolong the window in which a person can have children.
Do biologists have good hypotheses about why wi human women's fertility drops off maybe 20 or 30 years before the potential end of their lifespan, when this is not the case for a whole lot of other mammals?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So most mammals do not have the same long post-reproductive life cycle that human females have. And in fact, we only share that really with a few species of toothed whales. So an elephant, for example, can have a baby up until the end of its lifespan almost, and even a chimpanzee can. But us and killer whales and narwhals and beluga whales go through menopause and have years of our life where we can't get pregnant. And it's interesting, that science, this is a really understudied area of science. Evolutionary biologists have theories, but they don't really quite know why we go through this. And there's very little understanding about just biological reasons and for example, the timing of it, why it starts, what in the body initiates the process, why there's such a large window in which it might begin, because it's kind of like this 14-year window where, you know, some people begin it in when they're 35, some when they're 45, you know, don't hit it when they're 50 until they're 50. And there's very little understanding, even though there might be clues to overall aging, not just for women, but for everybody.
Yeah, and it's really hard to know where a woman's body is in that process if she's thinking about getting pregnant at a relatively later age.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of good fertility diagnostics. So, you know, let's say you would like to prolong your fertility, but you know, you still have, you're 25, you hope you're going to meet somebody. You know, it'd be kind of good to know where you're at in that timeline. And they do have a few tests to kind of indicate your hormone levels, but they're not conclusive, and there's no way to know exactly how many eggs you have left, or even whether they're of good quality.
Would IVG likely end the market or really shrink the market for donor eggs and sperm?
I don't think so. That's a good question. You know, some people I think would really need a lot of convincing to be sure that the technology would be safe. And so it might, and it, you know, especially initially, it's going to be really expensive. So it's not going to be a widespread technology, assuming they can even achieve it, for at least a couple of decades. And even then, I think some people might feel safer using donor eggs or sperm.
So let's talk about who's working on this. You visited this company called, this is a great name for a company like this, Conception in Berkeley, California, run by a guy who is motivated in part by hoping that someday he could have biological children with a male partner.
Yeah, the CEO of Conception is named Matt Kristoloff, and he's a gay guy. And yeah, you know, and one of his co-founders, Pablo Hurtado Gonzalez, is also gay. And for both of them, yeah, that is the motivating reason for working on the technology.
They've raised a lot of funding from investors. What specific scientific problems are they trying to solve at the moment, given that they are far from doing this with humans?
Yeah, so they're basically attempting to recreate in their lab the process that the Japanese scientists achieved with mice within egg cell. And they're only focused on egg cells right now. They aren't attempting to make sperm cells. So they're working with human blood cells, and they created a stem cell line from those blood cells, and then they're growing, you know, they're trying, basically they start trying to grow what's called a primordial germ cell, but then they also have to recreate in the lab the ovarian environment. So they've created almost these mini ovaries in a petri dish that they call ovarian organoids. And they put the germ cells, they combine that with the mini ovary and try to coax that cell into the same path of growth that it would have in the human body.
I thought it was interesting that the CEO of Conception, Mark Kristoloff, doesn't have like a hard science degree. What is his background?
Yeah, Matt, it's Matt Kristoloff. He studied, you know, a humanity, he has a humanities degree and from undergrad from the University of Chicago. And then he was an entrepreneur from a very young age who went to work for Y Combinator, the startup incubator that's well known, the Silicon Valley startup incubator, and was present at the time. At the time, Sam Altman, who's been in the news lately, was the president of Y Combinator. And he and Matt were working together on a research nonprofit wing. And Matt was also present for the beginning, like the first year of OpenAI. So he comes from this Silicon Valley school of thought that I think is actually pretty new in the past few years, that's really interested in not so much developing a business product like, you know, with an immediate path to profit as answering really hard science questions with a long research path.
Are clues emerging as to whether a technology like IVG might be either accepted or rejected by, say, the religious right?
Yeah, that's so far unclear as far as I could tell, but any technology in the United States that involves embryos, fetal tissue, pregnancy, you name it, gets drawn into the polarized debate over abortion. It's inflected really every aspect of reproductive science. And so I expect that there will be some kind of response, but it's not totally clear what it might look like yet.
It is pretty extraordinary, though, that scientists have found a workaround. They no longer need to derive stem cells from existing embryos, right?
That's correct. A Japanese scientist named Shinya Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize in 2012 for figuring out how to make a stem cell by reprogramming an ordinary somatic cell in the body.
I've always heard that, you know, stem cells can turn into absolutely anything. It is pretty extraordinary that anything includes an egg cell. It seems, in my mind, like an egg cell is like more specialized than other cells in the body.
It truly is. And when I spoke with researchers about egg cells who study them, you know, they're kind of obsessed with them and fascinated by them. They're the largest cell in the human body. They're extremely complex. They go through, you might remember from high school biology that gametes or reproductive cells have a different kind of cell division that allows them to divide their chromosomes to, you know, join with another, join with another person's DNA. And in egg cells in particular, that process, meiosis, is extremely complex, and goes through multiple phases, and it's so interesting.
I think what's so interesting when you think about, embryo selection in these cases, most people agree that it's entirely appropriate to select embryos that will be free of certain genetic diseases. When it comes to selecting for traits that we think will be useful, this is a giant responsibility, right? Like what we think might be helpful to a future child, it's really hard to predict what the future environment will be.
Yeah, I mean, that there will need to be a lot of societal discussion about that, I think, because, it reminds me a little bit of trying to name what you think you want in a partner when you're internet dating. I write a lot about internet dating, but you actually can't, you know, imagine if everybody has the same skill set, what kind of world that would be, or if everybody has the same propensities. But right now, the genetic, the data on, for example, I don't know, something like IQ, theoretically, it's not really there. You can't, I don't think the science is that good to be able to predict that kind of metric yet.
So as long as researchers are working with animal cells and tissues, what is the regulatory and ethical climate around this sort of thing? Is it anything goes until you get into dealing with human beings or potential human beings?
I wouldn't say that it's anything goes. Different states have different restrictions on embryos in particular and how they're legally treated. And there's an international convention that now is being shifted a little bit, but a limitation on making an embryo past 14 days. But where the government will likely really step in is should this be brought to the stage of human clinical trials. And in that case, it's not clear exactly what will happen, at least in the U.S. The FDA doesn't really regulate IVF as a process, but it does regulate biological products. And a lab-made egg cell will likely fall under that designation.
Even if this never gets to where it is used to create human embryos, lots of people are excited about the possibility for saving or preserving species that are nearly extinct, right? Animal species.
Yeah, that's another promise with this is there's already been some research trying to make an egg cell from the, I believe, the northern white rhino. There's only two females left of that species. And there are other people that are banking material from animals facing extinction, genetic material, in the hopes that one day they could reproduce them.
There's also the question of outcomes, right? Like if a private company is making an egg or sperm cell rather than just harvesting it naturally from a prospective parent's body, would that company face liability if the baby conceived with these products was born with genetic abnormalities?
Yeah, that's a question that will be left to legal scholars in the future. I don't even quite know how it works now with IVF, but these are the kind of questions that are would still need to be worked out. And actually, the National Institutes of Medicine had a workshop last week. So the government is starting to think about these questions and hold discussions about what the legal and ethical landscape would look like.
What are, Emily, some of the things that can go wrong when the source for an eventual egg cell comes from something like a skin cell? I think you said it was skin from the tip of a mouse's tail that is being used to derive these stem cells, which are turned into egg cells.
Yeah, so when an egg cell forms normally in the body, it's made from embryonic stem cells that have not been exposed much to the environment because it's the beginning of life and they're new. And the problem with making a stem cell from, say, a skin cell is the skin cell might have acquired a lot of mutations over the course of a person's life. So one theory is that the way, the material from which we'll be making these cells might be taken at birth, like it might be like a blood sample taken at birth that then is somehow preserved or turned into a stem cell line that then would not have all of these possible mutations.
All right, this is a, I'm going to grant you a strange hypothetical, but could IVG potentially be used to create a gamete from the cells of someone who has no idea this is happening? Like in my mind, I'm imagining like some celebrity's blood sample at the doctor's office being sold off to make babies.
Yeah, so that's one of the ethical issues that's been raised as a possibility with this technology is that it would make unknowing or unconsented parenthood theoretically much easier, and you could have that kind of scenario.
Wow, it does feel like there needs to be a whole new branch of law to cover this. This is interesting, as you said, to you as a journalist, but also as a human being. You have some eggs frozen. The odds of a successful pregnancy from frozen eggs are less than 50%. Can we assume that a technology like this would, at the very least, give people more chances if they want to have a pregnancy later in life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the hope and the promise of it. We're living much longer, many of us, than we used to. We're getting married later or not at all. In the US and in many countries, women are having babies much later than they used to. And there's a sense of frustration that the science hasn't really kept up with the way that we live our lives when it comes to human reproduction.
So this technology could hold huge promise for same-sex parents potentially, and for parents with infertility issues. Why do some advocates worry it could also make things worse for families in which children and parents are not biologically related?
Yeah, I mean, I think some people worry about this supremacy of the genetic relationship. And a lot of LGBTQ advocacy in recent decades has gone toward finding legal recognition of what are, you know, social relationships that a social a person that's not genetically related to their child is still, you know, their parent and as are as close as they could be, as family can be. And so I think there's some hesitation or worry about what it means to have so much emphasis placed on genes. And I think also even for people that have chosen to be childless, should the window of choice be extended in this way, it adds, you know, another few years of pressure on people that might have yeah. happily kind of settled into their life as it is.
Yeah, whether that pressure comes from society or whether that pressure is somehow internal, it's going to be there.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, right now I think the statistic is 85% of women have given birth by the age of 44. So when you're, you know, I'm 42, I don't have kids. When you're in that minority, you definitely, it doesn't matter how happy you are with your life. Like for me, having children was never quite a priority, but you still feel the sense of being outside of something and that pressure. I think, no, you'd have to have some kind of preternatural self-possession not to feel that.
Who do you think will be the first people willing to try this once the technology is made available to humans?
So everyone I spoke with, whether it was the private companies or the academic researchers, gets emails regularly from people that want to donate their genetic material to the research, that want to volunteer for clinical trials. I mean, having a child for some people is that important that they would be willing to be at the vanguard of science to achieve that goal.
Why are the first human trials, if we get that far, almost certainly not going to take place in the United States?
I think it goes back to our environment around reproduction. And, you know, the U.S. has a history of using healthcare as a form of social control. And in this case, the use of embryos, the use of, you know, pregnancies that might need to be terminated, it will likely open another Pandora's box of there's a kind of new political front. And other countries, you know, one scholar told me that it's far more likely that clinical trials would happen in the UK first because they just have a less polarized debate over reproduction. And they also have a government agency that kind of covers the regulatory and ethical issues of fertility.
The first IVF baby was born in the UK, right?
That's correct. Yep.
So did you learn anything about who the investors are in this technology? As you mentioned, you know, we're years out from this having any kind of broad scale commercial application. These are obviously people who are willing to wait for results.
Yeah, I mean, the investors are some of the, you know, top people in Silicon Valley. You have a young investor named Laura Deming who has a longevity fund that's interested in issues of aging. She's given money. Sam Altman gave money to Conception. There's another startup called Gamito and the founder of 23andMe and Wojcicki, I don't know how to say her last name. Sorry.
I don't know how to say it either, but I can picture it spelled in my head, so it's fine.
Yes, exactly. She, you know, she's one of the investors in that. Jan Tallinn, the founder of Skype. I think it's definitely trendy in Silicon Valley circles right now. I think there's also a kind of maybe strain of alarmism or a kind of pronatalist streak that's going on there right now about population decline. You know, Elon Musk has spoken about that a lot. And so this kind of fits into that trend or mindset as well.
We are in a weird place with that, aren't we? Like, on the one hand, there are many people who would like to have biological children that can't or don't have them. There are also declining birth rates everywhere in the world, pretty much at the moment.
Yeah. So the overall population of human population is continuing to grow and is expected to plateau, I think, at around 10 billion toward the end of the century. But in many countries, there's been a pretty sharp decline in reproduction. Some countries are down to something like 0.8 births per woman. I think that's South Korea and a few other places. So, for some people, that's not the worst thing, that there's social and environmental benefits to controlling what's been an explosive growth that's taxed the resources of the planet and the environment. On the other hand, there are, economists have warned that there will be economic and social consequences if related to societies that are too top heavy and are too aging. It'll affect pension systems, healthcare, all of that. But it's definitely on people's minds right now. And I think, for many of us, the ideal solution would be just that everybody who wants to have a baby can have a baby, and that that baby is supported and loved and cared for, and the parent as well. And this might be one way to extend the window in life in which people can have children.
Does anybody working on this technology imagine that it might be used not only by hypothetically same-sex couples or couples with infertility issues or single people who want to conceive a child, but also by people who, could have a baby the old-fashioned way, but prefer to conceive this way for some reason?
Yeah, so there's an author from Stanford. He's a bioethicist at Stanford named Hank Greeley, and he wrote a book called The End of Sex, in which he predicts that because this would make pre-implantation genetic diagnosis much easier than it currently is, that it will become a preferred method to conceive.
Do you mind if I ask, like, emotionally reporting on this story, does it strike you as like this fascinating, cool way of the future, or does it alarm you a little bit? Or I don't know if you landed on either side.
I guess I loved reporting this story so much. Everybody I spoke of was so smart, and I guess because, as a cis female, this inexorable deadline, I think I've been aware of it my whole adult life, this deadline, like, oh, don't forget to have a baby, don't forget to have a baby. It's affected my relationships, it's affected, my romantic choices. All it's this kind of pressure that's always with you. So for me, just to have this little window into a possible future where that might not be the case, even though it won't apply to my own life, was filled me with kind of optimism and excitement. But yes, on the other hand, there are dystopian outcomes. This idea that you could, I think already of the pressure parents feel to kind of make the perfect child that goes to piano classes and math classes and knows how to code and gets into Harvard. I mean, this I think could potentially exacerbate that approach to parenting, and in a way that it depresses me to think about, because in an ideal world, I think we would all be able to succeed in life without being, a rocket scientist or,
Emily Witt is a
6 feet tall.
Emily Witt is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where you can read her article about the possible future of human reproduction titled Fertile Ground. Emily, this has been so interesting, and I really appreciate you making the time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and if you want the podcast, you can subscribe to it free wherever you get your podcasts. You can find it by searching for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.